From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It is really a disaster, and the people who aren't in New Orleans, I know, are dying to get back to their houses, but the people who are in New Orleans are, in all honesty, dying, and there could be a lot more casualties unless there's a lot of help real fast.
New Orleans and the Gulf region remain in a state of catastrophe following the devastating Hurricane Katrina. We'll get a report from the Tenet Memorial Hospital in New Orleans. Then U.S. forces in Iraq shoot dead a Reuters news agency sound man.
Too many journalists have been killed in Iraq, and too many journalists have been detained for reasons that are unclear. We have to find a way for journalists to operate safely when around the U.S. military.
We'll speak with David Schlesinger, the global managing editor of Reuters, and get a response from the U.S. military. And on this last day of Cindy Sheehan's vigil outside President Bush's estate in Crawford, we look back at the day her son Casey died.
Casey Sheehan was killed in Sadr City on April 4, 2004, in clashes with followers of Muqtada al-Sadr that erupted after the United States shut down their newspaper Al-Hawza. In Baghdad on April 6th and 7th, Sadrists told me that those fights started when U.S. forces fired on peaceful demonstrations.
We'll speak with journalist Rahul Mahajan, who was in Sadr City at the time of Casey's shooting, as well as the soldier, Thomas Young, who was shot on that same day there and is now paralyzed from the waist down. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New Orleans and the Gulf Coast region remain in a state of catastrophe following the devastating Hurricane Katrina. At least 80% of New Orleans is underwater. The city has no electricity and little drinkable water. Officials say New Orleans will be uninhabitable for weeks. On Tuesday, two levees broke, flooding areas of the city that appeared to survive the storm. The total number killed in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama remains unknown, but officials fear it will be several hundred. Officials in Harrison County in Mississippi say at least 100 people died there, mostly in the cities of Biloxi and Gulfport. At least 30 people died at a single housing complex in Biloxi known as the Quiet Water Beach Apartments. Thousands of homes in the region were destroyed, including the oceanfront home of Mississippi Senator Trent Lott. The governor of Louisiana, Kathleen Blanco, has ordered the entire city of New Orleans to be evacuated.
The magnitude of the situation is untenable. It's just heartbreaking.
On Tuesday, the city's mayor, Ray Nagin, had to be airlifted from City Hall due to the rising waters. Officials are now planning to evacuate everyone inside the Superdome, where at least 20,000 people have sought refuge. The emergency generators at the sports complex are now failing. There's no air conditioning in the building surrounded by water. Meanwhile, both city airports are underwater. The staff of the city's newspaper, the Times-Picayune, had to flee its newsroom Tuesday due to rising waters. The paper has been forced to publish only electronic versions. The city's main public hospital is no longer functioning and being evacuated. The U.S. military is reportedly helping to evacuate more than 1,000 people from Tulane University Hospital. Doctors are also concerned about the possibility of outbreaks of disease spread through sewage contamination of drinking water, spoiled food, insects, and bites from snakes and other animals. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is making unprecedented preparations to house at least 1 million people in the region whose houses were damaged or destroyed. FEMA's Bill Loki called the hurricane, quote, the most significant natural disaster to hit the United States. The Pentagon has ordered 5 Navy ships and 8 Navy maritime rescue teams to the Gulf Coast to bolster relief operations. Swift boat rescue teams are being flown in from California. While the National Guard has been taking part in rescue operations and law enforcement, some 6,000 members of Louisiana and Mississippi Guard have been forced to watch the catastrophe from 7,000 miles away in Iraq. 40% of Mississippi's National Guard and 35% of Louisiana's is in Iraq. Over the past 8 months, 23 members of the Louisiana National Guard have died in Iraq. Only New York's Guard unit has suffered as many deaths. The Times-Picayune reports the catastrophic flooding is expected to worsen over the next few days after rainfall from the hurricane flows into Lake Pontchartrain from upstream rivers and streams. The levees have broken. The water will keep rising in the city of New Orleans until it's at the same level as the lake and Mississippi River. President Bush announced he would cut short his vacation by 2 days and return to Washington today. He spoke on Tuesday in San Diego.
Right now, our priority is on saving lives. And we are still in the midst of search and rescue operations.
During Bush's appearance in San Diego, he also took the time to briefly play guitar while with country singer Mark Wills. Bush is expected to fly to Louisiana on Friday to tour parishes ravaged by the hurricane. On the streets of New Orleans, martial law has been declared. There have been reports of looting, including many people breaking into stores in search of food and drinkable water. Others took electronics, alcohol, and guns. The Times-Picayune reports looting was so widespread that even police officers took part. One uniformed officer was photographed carrying 6 DVDs outside a Walmart. Another was seen carrying a 27-inch TV. Katrina is expected to become the costliest hurricane ever, more than Hurricane Andrew, which cost $21 billion. The hurricane's already affecting the nation's economy. Most of the oil and gas production facilities in the Gulf of Mexico have been shut off since Monday, and many sustained damage. The area normally accounts for a third of domestic oil production and a fifth of its natural gas output. The cost of gasoline is expected to soon rise to about $3 a gallon in many parts of the country. Areas including Atlanta may also face severe gas shortages. The two main pipelines that bring gas and jet fuel to Atlanta are down. The region now only has a 2-day supply of gasoline. Questions are also being raised if the federal government could have done more to protect the region from the deadly flooding. In 1995, Congress authorized the Southeast Louisiana Urban Flood Control Project. Over the past decade, the Army Corps of Engineers has spent $430 million on shoring up levees and building pumping stations. But another $250 million in work remained. According to press accounts, the federal funding largely froze up in 2003. Over the past 2 years, the Times-Picayune paper has run at least 9 articles that cite the cost of the Iraq invasion as a reason for the lack of hurricane and flood control funding. Earlier this year, President Bush proposed significantly reducing the amount of federal money for the project. He proposed spending $10 million. Local officials said 6 times as much money was needed. We go now to New Orleans. Early this morning, I reached Bill Quigley there. He is law professor at Loyola University. I spoke to him on his cell phone from Tenet Memorial Hospital, where he's volunteering, helping out his wife, Debbie, who's an oncology nurse. He said there are 1,200 people in the hospital. I asked him to describe the situation in the city.
This is the sort of the nightmare scenario that everybody was really worried about. But the problem for New Orleans is that everybody who had their health, had money, and had a car, they left. Okay, so we have probably 100,000 people trapped in the city right now, maybe 50 or 60,000 people in the Superdome who are there without electricity, without flushing toilets, without food, without water. There are people who had to walk over there or take a bus because they didn't have a car to get out. But there's people in nursing homes. There's people in these little hospitals all over the place. And then there's still, we can see when you're looking out the window at night, you can see some flashlights in the water where people are walking around out in the neighborhood. It's completely dark where you see a flashlight where somebody's walking down the water. And as we said, tomorrow night, you're not going to see those flashlights because tomorrow night they expect that we're going to have 9 to 15 feet of water. So those people that are walking out there with flashlights, they're not going to be there. And the hospitals are full. The hospitals are turning people away because they don't have enough food and water to be able to take care of the people who are in the hospital. So there was a boatload of people that came apparently to the hospital this morning or this afternoon, a father, a mother, and 2 little kids. They came in a boat, and the people at the hospital turned them away, sent them away because they didn't have room for them. Another 20 people walked up to the parking lot, parking garage. They'd been in the Holiday Inn downtown, and that Holiday Inn lost electricity, lost everything. So those people just left, and they've been wandering around the city looking for a place to stay, and the security guards had to turn them away. They sent them back into the floodwaters because they didn't have enough food or water or that to even be able to take care of necessarily the people that are here.
Bill,
so who's left behind in New Orleans right now? You're talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind, and those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like, and the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car. All these things. There's no plan for that. And so we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood, I think, of 100,000 people probably in the metropolitan New Orleans area that are still here. And the suggestions from local officials are, in the suburban parish next to us, they announced on the radio, we have one radio station, have no TV, have no cell phones, nothing. The only calls we're able to get are the calls that come in. And the suggestion was that people should take a boat over toward the interstate, and then they would pick them up there. But, you know, these people don't have a car. People live in an apartment with their mother and, people who are sick. That's why they couldn't leave. They don't have cars. They certainly don't have boats. And so there's a huge humanitarian crisis going on here right now.
Bill Quigley, I wanted to ask, this is a bit of an odd question. You're a law professor. We usually talk to you about the crisis that's going on in Haiti, where you have been a number of times and represent, among others, Father Jean-Just, who's in prison there. How does what you're seeing in New Orleans right now, how does it compare to Haiti?
Well, I would always hope that Haiti would become more like New Orleans, but what's happened is New Orleans has become more like Haiti here recently. You know, we don't have power. We don't have transportation. At this point, there's at least the people in the hospital have some fresh water, but they're telling people you can't drink the water out of the taps. So there's people wandering around the city without water, without transportation, without medical care. So in many senses, we got about 1 million people in the New Orleans area who are experiencing, you know, what Haiti is like.
Have you seen any National Guard?
There are apparently some National Guard who are on the roof who are helping with the helicopters. We've seen one or two here or there. There's been reports that there's thousands of them that are coming in. But, again, I don't know how they would get in. People are not able to, you know, the communication system is so bad that for a large part of the day, the mayor, the chief of police, the governor and those people couldn't call the one working radio station. And so they had to walk into the radio station, be able to talk to the people who are out here trying to figure out what's going on. So it is really a disaster. And the people who aren't in New Orleans, I know, are dying to get back to their houses. But the people who are in New Orleans are, in all honesty, dying. And there could be a lot more casualties unless there's a lot of help real fast.
Bill Quigley is a law professor at Loyola University. He was speaking to us from the hospital. He's staying at Tenet Memorial Hospital in New Orleans, where his wife, Debbie, is an oncology nurse. After we spoke to him early this morning, the backup electricity, went out at the hospital. And as this country remains focused on the devastation in New Orleans, tragedy also struck today in Iraq. More than 650 people have died in Baghdad in a stampede of Shiite pilgrims. The deaths came as about 1 million Shiites were marching in a major religious ceremony. Rumors spread that suicide bombers were in the crowd. Most of the victims were either crushed to death or drowned in the Tigris River. Earlier in the day, 16 Shiite pilgrims died after mortar rounds had been fired into the crowd. There are also more than 300 injured in that stampede. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A cameraman for Reuters in Iraq has been ordered by a secret tribunal to be held without charge at Abu Ghraib prison until his case is reviewed within 6 months. Ali Omar Abraham al-Mashadani was arrested by U.S. forces on August 8th after a search of his home in the city of Ramadi. The U.S. military has so far refused Reuters' request to disclose why he's being held. He has not been charged. U.S. military spokesperson Major General Rick Lynch responded to questions from journalists about the tension of Ali al-Mashadani.
We don't arbitrarily detain individuals across Iraq, regardless of what their profession is. If they're conducting an act that is suspicious, that we believe is tied to the insurgency, we have the authorities to detain that individual and then put him into the process that I've articulated.
Okay, but journalists is a special profession in this case. Are you recognizing that that is a special case?
Yeah, what we got to do is look at the individual that was indeed detained and what was he doing, regardless of what his profession was.
So that's no.
That's no.
Meanwhile, journalist organizations are calling for the immediate release of Mashadani. This is Ismail Zahir, chair of the Iraqi Union of Journalists.
This is unacceptable. The arrest of our colleague for 50 days plus is something have no answer, no question, no explanation, and no reason. We cannot accept it as a Iraqi Union of Journalists and as a professional journalist working on the ground. We cannot accept the way the American forces, military forces, behave toward Iraqi journalists.
The news of al-Mashadani's detention comes just 3 days after U.S. forces in Iraq shot dead a Reuters news agency soundman. On Sunday, Walid Khaled died of several bullet wounds to the head and chest. He was shot while on assignment covering the killing of two policemen in Hayal Adil. Camera person Haider Khadem was also wounded in the attack and then detained by U.S. troops for questioning. Between 52 and 67 journalists and media workers have been killed in Iraq since the U.S. invasion began in March 2003. Two Reuters camera people have been killed by U.S. troops there since the invasion. A third was shot dead by a sniper in Ramadi last November in circumstances for which Reuters is still seeking an explanation from U.S. forces. U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Salmeh Khalilzad, responded to the killing of Walid Khaled on Tuesday.
In Iraq, do they have a shoot first, ask questions later policy? We need some clarification.
Well, of course, we think the freedom of the press is critical for building a democratic order. And that's why we encouraged in the draft of the Iraqi constitution that right, that reality, that recognition be enshrined. As I said before, we will investigate. I don't know what you mean that there is a lack of cooperation. We'll investigate, and when the results of the investigation are produced, when the investigation is completed, we will let you know, and we will let everyone else know what happened, and we'll draw the right lessons from it and say what needs to be said after the investigation is completed.
We're joined now from London by David Schlesinger, the global managing editor of Reuters News Agency, and on the line from Baghdad, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, spokesperson for the U.S. military in Iraq. Let's begin with David Schlesinger. Can you talk about the death of your sound man and the detention of the man who was with him, as well as another Reuters journalist?
Right. Well, the one piece of good news I can tell you is that I've just had confirmation that Haider Khadem has been released to Reuters, which is very good. I thought it was really extraordinary that he was being held, though wounded and though his companion had been shot, that he had been held for so long. But he was just released. I got the news about 10 minutes ago. So we're getting him treated in Baghdad, and of course we will want to hear his story of what happened. My sense is that you gave a very good introduction to some of the problems that we're facing in Iraq. We've had now four people die while covering the war, and they're among, as you said, an extraordinary number of journalists who have been killed during this conflict. And now there are probably five or so journalists who are being held for rather inexplicable reasons. And all this has made it an extremely difficult conflict to cover, and yet it's clearly a vital conflict to cover. The role of journalists has never been more important because there's a global interest in the story. It's an important country. It's a country where horrible things are happening, like the stampede today. That wouldn't be known to the world unless there were journalists who are brave enough, willing to cover the story. And yet, if they can be killed on site, if they can be detained for reasons that are not made public, if there can be secret tribunals where journalists cannot even have the benefit of their own counsel, let alone have the charges against them made known to their employers or family. That makes it extremely difficult to cover the story and makes Iraq one of the more extraordinary and difficult countries in the world for journalists to operate in today.
Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, can you respond to the killing of Reuters soundman as well as to the detention of the two others?
Well, that is still under an ongoing investigation. We cannot, or we normally do not also comment on ongoing investigations other than that. That is our standard practice, has been our standard practice, and will continue to be our standard practice. The detention of the cameraman was at the scene based on the circumstances surrounding what was happening. He was detained further because his answers to questions that he was being asked were inconsistent with the previous answers he had given, so that warranted further questioning. That is the extent of that. I understand that he was to be released today, and I'm glad to hear that he has been released. Nobody is doubting the bravery or the dedication of any journalists here in Iraq covering a war. A war is a dangerous place to cover, not only for the journalists, but the Iraqi civilians that live here and the service members from all the coalition countries that are serving here. It is a unique area to cover because of the type of conflict that it is. The terrorists and the insurgents here are using tactics similar to what the media would use to cover stories as a way to infiltrate areas, and so that puts an added burden on everyone on how to cover the story.
Lieutenant Colonel Boylan, Reuters reported that at the funeral was held for Waleed Khaled on Monday, that he was shot in the face and took at least four bullets to the chest. According to Reuters, U.S. soldiers were heard joking around when Khaled's family came to the scene of the shooting. They said as they inspected his corpse, a U.S. soldier said, "Don't bother, it's not worth it." Reuters said other soldiers joked among themselves just a few feet from the body. Your response?
I have no information on that. Like I said, this is an ongoing investigation. You have to also realize that the Reuters crew, as well as soldiers, were responding to an ongoing firefight or a conflict between Iraqi police and insurgents. So you have to understand the area that they're in and the situation that they find themselves in. I am not familiar with the comments made, so I can't comment whether that did or did not happen.
Reuters, David Schlesinger, your report, your comment on that report.
Well, I think that the Lieutenant Colonel is correct in saying that we all respond to the same kind of situations, that for journalists go towards trouble. What worries me and concerns me greatly is that the last two journalists of ours who were killed, Dia Najim in November 2004, and then Waleed Khaled most recently, they were Iraqi. The journalists of ours who have been detained are Iraqi. And so what really worries me is it safe for an Iraqi journalist? I think that what needs to happen is to have a full, impartial, independent investigation into these detentions and the killings, so that some real lessons can be learned, and that the instructions of the military, the orders, the military doctrine, the rules of engagement can be modified so as to accept that journalists will be there, and that some of those journalists may be Iraqi, and not every Iraqi on the scene of a difficult situation should be shot at. That journalists are civilians, journalists are there to do a professional job. They need to be accorded rights. They need to be accorded a certain duty of care that is owed under the Geneva Convention to civilians. And simply because it's a difficult situation and they are Iraqi nationals, there are other Iraqi nationals who may be trying to do harm, that does not, if de facto, mean that they can be shot at.
Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, your response.
Well, it is a difficult situation, we've both said. The problem everyone finds themselves in at this point in time is the type of warfare that is going on. You have an enemy who does not wear uniforms, does not distinguish themselves between the civilians on the street who are trying to go about their daily business, the journalists on the street who are, or those that are credible journalists that are trying to get the story, and those that are trying to, as far as the insurgent terrorists, who are trying to cause harm and kill people.
So are you saying, sir, that if they were, if Waleed Khaled had been 6 feet tall and blonde with blue eyes, he wouldn't have been shot?
I'm not saying that at all. There have been other people who have been injured and sometimes killed when they have approached a situation that they may find themselves in that is a combat situation. What I am saying is you have a situation where it can be very confusing. You have an enemy who uses tactics that are hard to discern as far as whether they are civilian or journalists or enemy. It is incumbent upon the forces to do the best they can, as well as the journalists, to not rush headlong into a situation they may find themselves that put themselves in harm's way unnecessarily. It happens. We have had U.S. journalists killed. We have had foreign journalists killed. We have Iraqi journalists killed. We have had them injured. It is not a deliberate act to go after any journalist or civilian. Anybody that would suggest so is in grave error.
David Schlesinger, Global Managing Editor of Reuters.
Right, well, I guess what I would ask you, would you be willing to have an impartial, independent investigation into these incidents? Because certainly the investigations that we've been able to see, and certainly we haven't yet received in the investigation into the Dia Najim incident, but the earlier investigations into the killing of Taras Prochik in April 2003, the killing of Mazen Dana in August of 2003, there were many parts redacted. There were many parts, it was unclear whether the recommendations even of the military's own investigating officers would be carried out, because we haven't actually seen much sign of it on the ground. So would you be willing to have an independent, impartial, open investigation into these deaths so that both sides can learn the lesson?
That would not be my decision to make. That would be the commander of multinational forces plus potentially Iraq. For example, on I believe it's Mr. Mashandani. He was just, and there's been a news release that has gone on that today, the what was called the CCRB, which is the Combined Review and Release Board, voted after seeing the evidence against him, and they voted to continue to detain him. And in fact, I believe the magistrate cell recommended that his file be reviewed by the Iraqi-led board, and they are a majority. The Iraqis are a majority on that board, in fact.
Right, but he was not accorded the right to have counsel. The charges against him have not been made public, if there are indeed charges. The evidence, from all the indications, the only evidence that is being used against him is evidence taken from his own camera, which was all gathered during legitimate news gathering. So I'm a bit at a loss what the reasons are. Can you be public about the reasons?
I have not seen the evidence. I have not seen the reports. This is not Western. Though I think a lot of people have issue with this because everybody wants to apply Western peacetime issues in a wartime zone, and that is just inaccurate. And there has been a review board set up that has been operating very well. There are thousands of detainees that go through this process. There have been just over 1,000 detainees that have been released, I believe, at the beginning of this week or end of last week. The process may not be as fast as everyone would like. However, it is the most effective process that we have at this time, and it's combined with the Iraqi government.
Well, I mean, effective is an interesting word. I mean, I do accept that Iraq is not the United States, it is not the United Kingdom. I accept that, but I also think that what is in a journalist's camera gathered during his professional activities shouldn't be used then to try to make inferences about what he himself is. And even if it is, he should be accorded the right to counsel so that he can, rather just being one young man against a review board, he can have some assistance in making his own case to rebut whatever evidence or whatever charges there may be.
Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan.
Yeah, that is the process we have at this time. I am not a lawyer. I am not involved in the process. And
No lawyers were involved in the process.
It's going to continue as it has been set up in conjunction with and led by the Iraqi government.
Just to clarify, the statement that has come out from the CRRB says that Mr. Mashadani remains a threat to the people of Iraq, and they recommended continued internment. This according to Lieutenant Colonel Guy Rudisil, referring to the hearing of the Iraqi-U.S. Combined Review and Release Board held at a secret location in Baghdad on Monday, continue to be held for another 180 days to be held at Abu Ghraib.
That's correct.
Let me ask about the killing of Taras Prostyuk, because there are four Reuters personnel, journalists, cameramen who've been killed in Iraq, either Iraqi or unembedded. Taras Prostyuk, the cameraman who was killed at the Palestine Hotel when the U.S. military opened fire. Your response to that, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan?
I am not familiar with all the cases. Each one is taken separately. I do not have access to the files. I just don't have any information on that specifically.
Well, David Schlesinger, Global Managing Editor of Reuters, what about this issue of Iraqi, Arab, and overall unembedded reporters?
Well, as I say, this is one that concerns me very much because, from my point of view, trying to provide an accurate report of what's happening, I need to use unembedded journalists as well as embedded. Embedded journalists travel with, say, a U.S. unit or a coalition unit. They become part of that unit, so they provide one aspect of the story. But I cannot rely on that 100%. I also have to rely on what's called unilateral or unembedded journalists to provide the other side of the story, because not everything can be seen through the narrow lens of what is seen by a unit. So to provide a full report, an accurate report, I feel I must have some unembedded, and along with me, certainly most of the major news agencies do the same thing. Yet it seems in my interactions with the U.S. military, with the Pentagon, that to paraphrase, it's basically if you're not embedded, we cannot do anything to protect you. And to me, that's a very worrying kind of attitude, because I think that journalists need to be accorded the rights under the Geneva Convention of civilians, not to be shot at willy-nilly, not to be harassed in doing their professional jobs. And so I'm very concerned at the danger that the unembedded journalists, the unilateral journalists, are facing.
Lieutenant Colonel Boylan.
I would say that the characterization of shooting at reporters willy-nilly is the furthest thing from accurate that could be said. Again, it is we cannot Monday morning quarterback this thing from the safety of thousands of miles away, while all forms of people, journalists, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, the Iraqi populace, is in a war zone.
Well, you're right there, right?
Happen.
You're right there, Lieutenant Colonel.
And I agree completely I absolutely agree that sitting in London, I cannot possibly judge their actions. That's why I'm calling for an fair, open, independent investigation, because I think no one can Monday morning quarterback. I'm the last person who could Monday morning quarterback what they did. But there does need to be an investigation, a fair investigation, so that we all can learn the lessons from these incidents.
David Schlesinger of Reuters, would you say that journalists are being targeted in Iraq?
Right.
No, I don't believe journalists are being targeted, but I do believe that it is extremely dangerous for journalists to operate. I believe that far too many journalists have been killed. I believe that the detentions of journalists are extremely worrying because of the chilling effect it has on their ability to do accurate reporting. I don't believe they're being targeted, but I do believe it's a very difficult, unhealthy atmosphere.
Well, on that note, we have to leave it there. We'll continue the discussion. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, though you may not be a top decision maker within the military, will you be recommending an independent investigation of the killing and the detention of these journalists?
I can definitely bring forward the concerns of Reuters to my chain of command. Beyond that, that would be all I could and should do at my level.
Well, I thank you both for being with us. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Boylan, spokesperson for the U.S. military in Iraq, and David Schlesinger, global managing editor of Reuters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we continue with our discussion today, President Bush's vacation is officially over this week as he returns to Washington. And there's little doubt that his time these past weeks at his Crawford, Texas estate will forever be remembered as the summer of Camp Casey, named for 24-year-old Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Baghdad's Sadr City on April 4, 2004. By now, you'd have to be living in a news vacuum to not know the name of Cindy Sheehan, Casey's mother, who set up a lawn chair down the road from Bush's property at the beginning of the president's five-week vacation to demand she be allowed to speak directly with the president. What grew out of that simple act was an anti-war tent city of sorts that's seen a stream of visitors, among them families with soldiers deployed in Iraq or who had their loved ones killed there, veterans of the current Iraq War, musicians Joan Baez and Steve Earle, actors Martin Sheen, Margot Kidder, and native activists and actor Russell Means. Scores of activists and others concerned or inspired people have joined the camp at various points. There have been literally hundreds of journalists at Crawford, among them the celebrities from the White House press corps. There have also been counter-demonstrators and pro-war families. Over these weeks, Cindy Sheehan's vigil has served as an igniting spark for the anti-war movement, has provided a gateway into a broader discussion across the country around the occupation of Iraq. Well, as Cindy Sheehan prepares to leave Camp Casey in Crawford today, we want to focus on the story of her son and his death more than a year ago in Baghdad's Sadr City. In fact, Casey Sheehan was killed on Sunday, April 4, 2004, and that Monday on Democracy Now! We reported on the battle in which he was killed. The nation has entered a new phase as Shiite Iraqis staged an armed uprising Sunday against the occupying forces in four cities. A total of at least 50 Iraqis and 10 U.S. troops died on Sunday. Hundreds were injured. The U.S.-led occupying forces lost control of at least one city. Police stations were burned in four others. The resistance continued early today in Basra, where dozens of Shiites occupied the governor's office. The young Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr called for the uprising after the U.S. shut down one of his newspapers and arrested one of his top aides. In a statement, Sadr said, "Terrorize your enemy. God will reward you well for what pleases him. It is not possible to remain silent in front of their abuse." That was our report on April 5th, 2004. President Bush and his supporters have sought to portray the resistance in Iraq as foreign fighters, terrorists, Saddam loyalists, and al-Qaeda. But the death of Casey Sheehan gives lie to that line. This is Cindy Sheehan talking recently about how her son died.
Casey was such a gentle, kind, loving person. He never even got in one fist fight his whole life. Nobody even hated him enough to punch him, let alone kill him. And that's what George Bush did. He put our kids in another person's country, and Casey was killed by insurgents. He wasn't killed by terrorists. He was killed by Shiite militia who wanted, they wanted him out of the country. When Casey was told that he was going to be welcomed with chocolates and flowers as a liberator, well, the people of Iraq saw it differently. They saw him as an occupier.
Cindy Sheehan. In a moment, we'll be joined by Cindy Sheehan and also by the U.S. soldier in Sadr City the same day that Casey Sheehan was killed.
But Thomas Young didn't die. He was severely wounded that day and is now paralyzed from the chest down. First, though, President Bush, what he had to say the first time he was asked publicly about the uprising in Saudi that took the life of Casey Sheehan and nine other soldiers.
The message to the Iraqi citizens is they don't have to fear that America will turn and run. And that's an important message for them to hear. If they think that we're not sincere about staying the course, many people will not continue to take the risk toward freedom and democracy.
That was President Bush, April 5th, 2004. At the time, Casey Sheehan and his fellow soldiers were killed in Sadr City on April 4th, the day before. Independent journalist and author Rahul Mahajan was in Iraq and reported on Democracy Now! About his time in Sadr City that weekend talking with U.S. soldiers. This is what he had to say.
Initially, I did. When I was in Sadr City a couple days after the outbreak of violence there, and I talked to some young men who were posted there. They'd only been in Iraq 3 weeks, and so they were more friendly and easier to approach. There was one we tried to talk to who simply kind of waved us on the way that most troops will do if they've been in the country for a long time. They get extremely wary and nervous. But these guys talked to us. They were perfectly nice. They were very, very ignorant of what was going on in Iraq. They were there in Sadr City because of clashes with al-Sadr's Mahdi army. And I asked them, so what do you think about this stuff with al-Sadr? What do you think about the Mahdi army? And they said, what? Who's that? Who are they? In fact, one of them was very curious and came up and asked us several questions trying to figure out who these people were. They were thrown in here. They don't know any Arabic. They don't even know how to say, please get away from the tank in a respectful way. And they're sent over here to kill people and die. And it is a shame.
That was independent reporter Rahul Mahajan right after the Sadr City battle. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by one of the soldiers who was there. And unlike Casey Sheehan, survived, though he was paralyzed. His name is U.S. Army Specialist Thomas Young. We'll also be joined by Rahul Mahajan as well as Cindy Sheehan. Stay with us.
شبابتي عبأتها أنفاسي الخضراء فلسطينية شبابتي عبأتها أنفاسي الخضراء وموالي عمود الخيمة السوداء في الصحراء.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Thomas Young, the young soldier, U.S. Army specialist, who fought in the same division as Casey Sheehan and was shot during the massive uprising in Sadr City on April 4th, 2004, the same day and place that Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, was killed. Thomas Young, now paralyzed from the chest down. He recently visited Camp Casey, where he, too, demanded to speak with the president. Joining us on the line from Austin, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Can you talk about that day, April 4th, 2004?
It started for me. I was sitting in the back of my vehicle, just listening to some music, and my squad leader came up and told me to get my gear and get in the back of the truck. We were going out on a mission, which was interesting for me to start with because I had recently switched positions in the company to be more of a company clerk kind of thing because I had previously enlisted at the age of 17. That was the kind of job that I had trained for. I was an infantry soldier the second go around, so I had kind of put myself in the more administrative position.
When had you arrived in Baghdad?
What's that?
When did you arrive in Iraq?
For 4 days prior to this being put on this mission.
And so you were sent to Sadr City. What did you do?
No, Sadr City was where we were. That was our camp. We weren't sent there. That was where the division commander volunteered us for that particular part of the city, of Baghdad.
And so what happened that day, April 4th?
I was put onto a truck with 24 other soldiers when I should have only been put with 17 for the maximum capacity of the truck. So we were all pretty crammed in there, pretty tight. And the truck had no canvas top to it. So it was just open, and nor did it have any armor on the sides. And we got in the truck, and we were going out to provide security for some downed soldiers, to provide security for a rescue mission for some downed soldiers in a part of the city. And so we went out there. We went out through a safe route, and we got to the mission site, and everything went fine. And we loaded back up in the truck, and instead of going back to the base the way we had come, we decided to go directly through the heart of Sadr City.
And what happened?
And as we were driving through, I guess, their main street, as it would be, there were Iraqi insurgents on the tops, on the rooftops of all the buildings. And to them, I mean, it must just look like fish in a barrel. Because we were all crammed in so tight, none of us could really get any space for our arms and our weapon to point out the truck to look at anybody. And they didn't really particularly have to aim. They could just hit anything they shot at. And the truck was driving very slow, and we were told to shoot at anything we saw that looked like a threat, and all I could see were women and children. And I could differentiate women and children from, you know, angry militant men that had guns, so I didn't shoot. There were other guys who, you know, because they were scared, they couldn't make that distinction, so they were shooting. And I would see occasions and instances where men with guns would go down, and I'd see, okay, we're hitting some, but I'm sure women and children didn't get hit. I'm not saying that. I couldn't see anybody, so I'm sure, I don't know.
Was your vehicle armored?
No, my vehicle was not. Mm-hmm. In my vehicle that I drove, or
that you were in.
That I was in the truck? No, we were in an unarmored vehicle that, as I said, the vehicle had no armor, and it had no top to the... There was no top, so they could just... It was open.
Did you understand why you were there, Thomas Young?
Why I was in Iraq?
Yeah, why were you in Sadr City that day? Why you were driving there? What was happening?
I didn't understand what was going on, why we were going through to the middle of the city.
I wanted to bring Rahul Mahajan in right now, independent journalist who was in Iraq at that time. Rahul Mahajan, what was your understanding of what was happening?
Well, you know, on March 29th, the Sadrist newspaper Al Hausa was closed. And what transpired later is that around that time also the CPA signed off on an order which it had been holding for almost a year to go to arrest Muqtada al-Sadr in connection with the murder of an exiled cleric, Abdelmajid al-Khoi. And then in response to that, there were a number of protests by Sadrists. I talked to Sadrist people in Shuala, Kadamiya, and in Sadr City, three mostly Shiite areas of Baghdad, and I got the pretty much the same story from all of them. It's hard to verify, but basically they said is after the closing of the newspaper, there were lots of peaceful protests. I'm not saying that they were unarmed, because nobody in Iraq really goes unarmed, but they were peaceful. The crowds were not firing, and they were more or less attacked by U.S. forces. In one in Baghdad, the protester was crushed under a tank. In several others, people were fired on by U.S. forces. And over the period from March 29th through April 3rd or 4th, there was an escalating dynamic of violence, and according to the Sadrists, really pushed by U.S. forces. And then it exploded in violence on April 4th in Sadr City and all through much of southern Iraq as well.
Rahul Mahajan, who was in Iraq at that time and then moved in and talked to U.S. soldiers. It's interesting to have you here, Rahul Mahajan, as well as one of the soldiers who was there, U.S. Army Specialist Thomas Young. Do you have a question for Thomas Young, Rahul?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's remarkable, I think. I was there only 3 days later in Sadr City talking to and interviewing the very people who were involved in these clashes. And it certainly, I do wonder several things, one of them being really what was the level of education about the specifics given to the soldiers? What were you told, Thomas, for example, about who you were fighting and why you were fighting them and what they were all about before you were sent in that open, unarmored truck?
In particular, I was told nothing about who we were fighting or what was going on. The only thing I was told was that we were going to provide security for a rescue mission for two soldiers that were down from another company. And it was to my understanding that once that was done for my particular truck, we were going back to the base.
Right. Well, of course, when you go on a
rescue
mission,
I was not told about why we were going towards the center of the city. I had no level of education as to what was going on that particular day or what was happening.
Well, of course, when you're going on a rescue mission in an area where there's active fighting, there's a good chance that you'll be fighting as well. And another thing I wonder is that one gets a general impression that U.S. soldiers are told basically these are a bunch of bad guys, these are a bunch of terrorists, given the impression that they are just sort of addicted to mindless violence and that's why you have to go and fight them. Was that the sort of general impression you had, or was there a feeling that there was some actual understandable reasons why, for example, these people might be fighting you?
For me, I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
Were you sort of given the impression that these people you might be fighting were basically mindless terrorists addicted to violence, or did you have a sense that there might actually be political reasons behind their attacking U.S. forces?
Well, for me in particular, my understanding was that was what I understood to be happening, that they had political reasons for wanting Americans out and all that, and again, to be fighting us. But from what the battalion level and all the higher-ups were trying to tell us, that they were just mindless terrorists who, yeah, they wanted to come over and destroy the American way of life, and that we were going to defend freedom. And, you know, that was definitely the rah-rah, gung-ho kind of attitude they were trying to instill in us so that we could, you know, feel more comfortable with going in and, you know, I guess killing them.
Thomas Young, why did you go to Camp Casey? You were on your honeymoon. You just got married, but you chose to go there this weekend.
I went to Camp Casey is because I had been watching the news, and I saw that President Bush wouldn't meet with Cindy because his reasoning was that he had already met with her, and I got to thinking, well, my life has been severely impacted by my volunteering to fight in this war, this, I guess, unjust war. What reasoning would he have to meet with me? Because he's never given me that honor. And unlike Cindy, I'm not gonna wait for him to meet with me. I'm not gonna follow his motor. I'm not gonna follow him back to Washington. if he wants to meet with me, he can find me. And likewise, his reasoning for not meeting me will find me also, because I have a TV.
We're talking to U.S. Army Specialist Thomas Young, who was paralyzed on April 4th, 2004, U.S. soldier in Sadr City. Paralyzed the day that Casey Sheehan was killed. We're also joined on the phone by Cindy Sheehan, Casey's mother, who started Camp Casey, went to Crawford on August 6th, and demanded to meet with President Bush. Today, Cindy Sheehan, is your last day at what's become known as Camp Casey. Your thoughts today and your feelings about Thomas Young coming to the encampment to join you, another young man in your son's division.
Well, it was an honor to meet Thomas and his wife, and I'm glad Thomas came out and shared the experience with us. I just disagree with him on one thing. It wouldn't be an honor for him to meet George Bush. It would be an honor to George Bush if he ever met Thomas, because Thomas has more courage and integrity in his pinky than George Bush has in his entire body. And our plans are now to find a piece of property right by George Bush's ranch and put up a veterans rehabilitation center there. So for the rest of his life, he'll have to look. George Bush will have to look and see what his policies did. He'll have to look at people like Thomas and know that he has devastated so many people in this country by his lies and his deceptions. And when I see people like Thomas, it just makes me resolve to fight even harder for our young people over there and for the people of Iraq and really for the people of the world. And Casey was killed in an LMTV like Thomas was in. They didn't even have their armor from Kuwait yet. They didn't have their tanks. They didn't have their Bradleys. And they sent our children to be sacrificial lambs, to be slaughtered, you know, in the city. And it just really proves that our babies, our precious, precious children are nothing but cannon fodder to these people. And I just want to encourage all of America, do not give your children to these maniacs. When mothers stop allowing their children to be sacrificed for greed, that's when the wars are going to stop.
What are your plans now, Cindy Sheehan, as you leave Camp Casey?
We're getting on the bus. We're not letting up, but now we're going to shift part of the pressure onto Congress. You know, Congress is as much, if not more, culpable for the bloodshed in Iraq, and we're going to keep the pressure on the president, obviously. You know, we had 1,500 people, excuse me, in San Diego while he was there the other day protesting his policies. We will keep the pressure on him, but now we're going to go to Congress. And, oh, excuse me, I don't have a voice anymore. And we're going to ask Congress the same questions we wanted to ask the president, but also we're going to put on top of it, how many more people are you willing to let die for this mistake before you call an end to it?
40% of Mississippi's National Guard, 35% of Louisiana's is in Iraq. Final comment on that, and we just have a few seconds.
I think, of course, it's George Bush's policies, and not only are their personnel over there, but their equipment is over there, too, and that's going to be devastating more than ever for those states.
Cindy Sheehan, will you be at the major anti-war rally in Washington on September 24th?
Absolutely.
And Thomas Young, will you be there?
Yes, I'd also like to say the reason I'm not going to follow the George Bush back to Washington is I have medical appointments at my VA all the time, so I'm coming back. I have lots of medical reasons to stay at home.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Army Specialist Thomas Young joining us from Austin, as did Rahul Mahajan joining us from Austin, and Cindy Sheehan, who is breaking camp today, leaving Camp Casey. They will be together again on September 24th. Special thanks to Kim Terpening, a.k.a. Alaska Girl, for photos of Thomas Young and his wife at Camp Casey. We'll link to her website at democracynow.org. Check out the pictures there. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, from Doug Caduce, John Hamilton, Anna McGarrah, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, Maddie Harper, and Nell Geiser, Susie Salome. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.